Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Nervous Herbalist, a podcast for Chinese medicine practitioners who like herbs and want to learn more about their function, their history, and treatment strategies to use in the clinic. Let's get into it. Hi there, everybody. Welcome back to The Nervous Herbalist. My name is Travis Kern, and I'm here with
Travis Cunningham.
And we are following up on our discussion about the theory and formulas for menopause with a case study today, so that we can give you guys a sense of how this played out with a real person, particularly because menopause is something that has an initial presentation and then has a tendency to change as we treat it. And then ultimately we'll need some kind of either resolution or maintenance, or how does that look? So we wanted to kind of lay it out so people could get a sense of it. So T, you've got a case for us.
Yeah, this is actually a perimenopausal case.
Do you want to make that distinction for folks? I know that we did it when we were in the theory area, but like when we're talking about perimenopause, menopause, postmenopausal,
sure.
What do we mean?
Yeah, it's just the time around a female-bodied person's span of when the menstrual cycle begins to stop, completely stops, and then the resulting factors mm-hmm. with that. Perimenopausal would be as it's stopping or before, like kind of as it's moving into menopause.
Yeah, so it's like the first part of it.
Yes, the first part of it. And what will happen for some people is they'll start to get some of the same symptoms that you would associate with menopause. The reason that I picked this case is there's a couple of key features in the case that I think are good to talk about relative to to treating perimenopause or menopause.
Okay. Well, with that setting the stage, tell us a little bit about the case we've got.
Yeah, so the case is a 46-year-old female, and the first visit was in November of 2024 here. So her chief complaint is hot flashes, and she has a very peculiar presentation of neuropathy that occurs in her hands and her feet, particularly after she goes to bed at night.
Okay.
So she feels tingling and strange sensations in her hands and feet at night. She also had her second child in May of that year, so close to 7 months before. Yeah, about 7 months prior.
Okay. And how old's the patient?
Patient is 46.
Got it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So a month or two, so this is the history, a month or two after the pregnancy, she experienced first pain in the left shoulder she wasn't sure what it was related to. It wasn't obviously connected to an acute injury situation. Then she started to experience tingling in the extremities, particularly in the hands. And this does actually occur sometimes during the day, but most frequently at night is when she experiences it. She's noticed that it gets worse if she eats chocolate, drinks wine, or is stressed.
Okay.
And bowel movements can be sticky, slightly loose, or sometimes she can skip a day. Her temperature is, she generally feels warm. She especially feels warm at night, but she has a preference for heat.
So a history of being cold-natured.
Yes.
But now she's got these hot symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But she also prefers warmth, which is kind of interesting, right?
Even still, even with the...
Even with the...
The hot flashes.
Yeah, the hot flashes and the elevated temperature. She generally prefers to be warm.
Okay.
Her periods have generally been scanty and a little bit painful. She's had cramping. She has to take a medication at times to deal with the pain from the cramping.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have palpitations, which is something I asked about. Her sleep is actually pretty easy for her to fall asleep. She wakes up sometimes with the sensation, right, that we talked about, the neuropathy, the tingling. But she doesn't get enough sleep. She's like, I got to get up, take care of my kids, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But she says, I sleep fine, I just don't sleep enough, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And she has hot flashes several times per day. She notices it I was like, how many times does it happen per day? And she's like, somewhere between 5 and 10 seems to be happening. I was like, okay. I checked the abdomen. The abdomen had a cold. The skin was noticeably cooler in the epigastric region, but was not necessarily painful at all when I pressed in. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of what we call RECU, the rectus abdominis tension, which is I think of it as a wet type RECU, which I can talk about that. It's just how the rectus abdominal tension presents. Mm-hmm. And then below the umbilicus, there was a lot of lax skin, very soft and very easy to press deeply, right? Gotcha. Which I associate with lower jaw deficiency.
So the abdominal muscular tension was above the umbilicus.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so once you sort of reached umbilical level and went below, it got soft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Describe that, the difference there between like a dry versus a damp presentation in the palpation.
Right. So you can have kind of two if we just say constitutional types are two instead of the five phase or six conformation or whatever, just the two, a damp person and a dry person, mm-hmm. right? A dry person will tend to be more thin and wiry and will tend to have obvious, you'll be able to feel the breadth of the muscle in the abdomen. So you'll be able to feel the rectus abdominis fully.
Mm-hmm.
Right. With a damp type person, the skin will be softer and the parts of the RECU that you feel will feel like little knots of very tiny knots, maybe the size of a pebble or something underneath the skin. And if you're palpating carefully, you'll be like, what is that? But it's actually just, it's still the rectus abdominis. It's still little dry spots in that muscle. It's just you can't feel the whole breadth of the muscle like you can in a dry type person.
Mm, okay.
So then the difference would be like, okay, well, you can have somebody who's dry and then has dryness in the muscle layer, right? That's an obvious correlation. But you can also, as it turns out, have somebody who's damp and has dryness in the muscle layer. And that would be like to pull up a formula real quick that would make sense, there would be like a Dongui Xiaoyao San, where you're using Bai Xiao at a very high dose, Xiaoyao at a high dose, you're using Dongui, but you also have Fuling and Baiju and Zexie. And, you know, so you have these compounding factors where you're nourishing on some way the let's say the nutritive aspects of the muscle layer, but you're also helping the body to transform dampness and water that's accumulating.
Sure.
Yep.
And so that, because this is the tricky thing about our medicine sometimes, is that, you know, we say damp person, dry person.
Yeah.
But of course, it so rarely presents with such clear lines.
Sure.
Where you have a damp person who's got dry muscles.
Sure.
And you're like, what's that about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and if you have a problem metabolizing fluids or dampness, you could easily see how dryness could be created, right? Mm-hmm. Because if it's not being nutritionally transformed, then it becomes not useful. But then the part of the body that needs that nutritional supplementation, also it isn't getting there, mm-hmm. right? It's out of right relationship.
Yeah, I think actually when you look at the way that people who carry a lot of dampness, the way that it manifests, there's actually almost always a significant amount of dryness in various parts of the body.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
And it's because the damp that's accumulating is accumulating because it's not being processed and disseminated.
Right? Yep.
It's sort of like collecting 100%. In this weird warehouses in your body, causing mm-hmm. trouble when it should have been metabolized, processed, and applied to some other layer right. in the system. So if you come across people who, you know, they've got dry skin stuff or like thinning hair stuff or things that are like, but you're so damp. Why mm-hmm. is this happening? That's why
mm-hmm.
the damp isn't making it where it needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is the finding. So for this patient, you found which type of the RECU again, the damp one or the dry one?
The damp one.
The damp one. Okay.
And the last detail on the abdomen is a slight amount of pulsations of the abdominal aorta, kind of around where the cold feeling is in the skin, like in the epigastric zone. Actually, in this patient, it's a little bit below what we would call the epigastric zone, but it's kind of like CV, between CV 12 and 14, if we were to label it with acupuncture points. Okay. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So right on the like distal edge of epigastrium.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. So with all those findings.
Yeah. So I decided to give Guizhi Ren Shen Tang, which is again the formula Li Zhong Wan with Guizhi. Mm-hmm. And then the Jergon Sao dose goes up to 12 instead of being at 9. Mm-hmm. So it's Guizhi 12, Ren Shen 9, Baiju 9, let's see, Jergon Sao 12, and Ganjiang 9, right? So I did that for 14 days, 8 grams twice a day in granule. So just that formula, no modifications. And I wanted to talk about this because the pattern of that versus the pattern of Xiao Jianzhong Tang looks very similar, right? It's also a Guizhi formula. It can also present very similarly in the abdomen. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, because of the general constitution of the patient trending more as a wet type or a damp type, to do the Guizhi Ren Shen Tang method instead of the Jianzhong Tang method, which would be more for a dry type person.
Right.
Yeah.
So when we were laying out the theoretical components for menopause, we kind of created this hierarchy, so mm-hmm. to speak, right? Of like qi movement problem, blood movement problem, middle jiao problem, blood deficiency problem. So based on your findings with this patient, you didn't find a need to move qi or move blood intrinsically. Correct. Is that right?
Yep.
And that's because you didn't see some of the signs that we talked about before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That, like, so if there was a need to move qi, we would see more costal tension and discomfort when I pressed under the rib side, right?
Right.
There would be more physical discomfort even when I pressed into the epigastrium, you know? So that could be the qi showing up in the abdomen. There would be different symptoms. There could be the tendency. So with hot flashes, it's a little tough to tell because people are generally alternating hot and cold.
Sure.
Right. So that part can be a little bit nuanced. But the other piece is strange taste in the mouth, the person gets dizzy, or any of the other symptoms we associate with a Xiaoyang presentation aren't really there in this case.
Yeah.
You know? So no need to move qi. The blood, there's no hard oketsu finding in the lower abdomen. I didn't mark it down here, but I did look at the tongue at some point, and the tongue didn't have the engorged sublinguals.
Right.
So there's, I'm not finding any need to really move the blood in a big way either,
mm-hmm.
you know, which could be a little surprising in a case like this, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, and I mean, you're going to this, you know, the Guizhi Ren Shen formula, but of course that's a warming formula, Li Zhong Wan plus Guizhi, right?
Yes.
Which is of course like warming and moving. And I mean, it doesn't move the blood in the way that, you know, Taoren moves the blood, right? But there is a kind of passive tonification to blood movement by sure. warming and working in that space.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, Guizhi's red and all yep. that fun doctrine of signature stuff. So basically in your evaluation, you could tell like, oh, we don't need to do anything with qi. We take a look at the blood. Doesn't seem like we need to move anything directly with the blood. So we go to the next layer, which is this middle jiao function piece. And yeah. that's where you start.
That's where I started.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So she took it for 2 weeks.
Yep.
And then what did we get?
So the 2 week mark, so I have down, she finished bleeding yesterday. So her menses, her period ended yesterday. Pain was not as bad this time. Mm-hmm. So pain had an improvement. The bleeding was a bit heavier, actually. Some clots big and small. Neuropathy has in general been much better over the last couple of weeks. She didn't experience any the week prior to menses, but after bleeding, some has returned. It's still better than before.
What did you make of the neuropathy itself? What do you think's going on there?
So I think the neuropathy is related to blood deficiency.
Mm.
And because the circulation is slowing down at night, right? The blood is moving less at night. And if the blood is already deficient, then it's not able to circulate and nourish the tissues in the extremity in the same way. So the channels aren't being properly opened, you know,
right.
with a lack of resources there.
So then tingling and numbness.
The tingling and numbness is related to that.
Got it. Okay. So stuff's better after 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
but still obviously present.
Still obviously present.
So what's the move?
So I checked the abdomen again. I found pretty much the same thing. But to me, the recue was a lot more discernible this time. So it was more prominent. I felt more spots, which again shows the muscle layer dryness piece. So I actually switched to Dongui Jianzhongtang. So I actually used the Jianzhongtang principle second after doing Guizhi Ren Shentang.
And that's because you didn't feel like the first one was moistening the muscle layer enough.
Yeah.
So even though she's got this sort of constitutionally damp presentation, you go for that move. It seems to nourish a little bit, but not enough. And the muscle layer feels maybe even more dry than before.
Right.
So you shift more toward the dry approach.
Yes.
Because it's going to be more moistening
yes.
to the muscle layer.
Yep.
Okay. Dosage?
Yeah, I
same did. Same 8 again?
I did 8 twice a day. And then let me look at the next. Yeah, basically 2 weeks again. 2 weeks until the next appointment.
Okay.
So at the next appointment, she came back in and basically since the previous appointment, since she started taking the new formula, she had no neuropathy symptoms.
Hmm.
And I don't think we mentioned the hot flashes actually, which is kind of one of the points. Hot flashes were much better.
After the first one.
After the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, stuff in general was better, but the hot flashes were distinctly better.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So at this point, basically both symptoms stopped. The hot flashes she hadn't experienced in at least a week.
Okay.
And the neuropathy hadn't occurred since the previous appointment. So like 2 weeks.
Mm.
The neuropathy got better faster. And the hot flashes seem to get better, you know, a little bit later, but mm-hmm. but still better.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested by that shift because it sounds like the first formula that you gave, right? It obviously was still focused on nourishing the muscle layer.
Yeah.
And that nourishment, which you hypothesized was the lack of that nourishment was why she was having the neuropathy.
Yep.
That she's getting nourished from the first 2 weeks of the formula because like, to start taking the next formula for like a day or two and all of a sudden neuropathy just goes away, that wasn't just because you switched to that formula.
Right.
That's
it was already like, trending well.
Yeah, like the moistening was already happening and here we just turned up the moistening more rapidly.
I think also too, the you know, like this was the day after bleeding finished. So if you have a blood deficiency person who then goes through the bleeding process,
right.
The symptoms that we associate with blood deficiency are worse during the bleeding.
Yeah.
Right. It may just take a few days for the body to recover the blood loss.
Yeah.
And
well,
then the symptoms get better.
I mean, the cycle point is changing, right? So now the body's going back into build
yes.
and construct
yes.
and nourish and accumulate. So it's also like trend wise in terms of like the menstrual cycle's different sections, it's a good spot to grab it.
It
because
is.
You're actually on the building and nourishing side, that's a great spot to transition the formula to be more nourishing, lean into the natural curve that the body's on.
Yes.
Okay. So at the end of the second 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
the neuropathy's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So she hasn't had it at all.
Right.
That's great. And the hot flashes are also gone?
They're also gone.
Completely gone.
Completely gone.
Wow.
Yeah. For at least a week. The second week, yeah, was really when they sort of stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, according to the patient's report.
Okay, so then what then?
So I stayed the course. You know, I didn't feel like anything major needed to change. I found pretty much the same thing in the objective findings. The symptoms are getting better. The objective findings are very similar. So I basically stayed the course and we did that for about another month.
Okay.
And then at that point, the patient had still had no return of the hot flashes. And the neuropathy had not come back.
Okay.
So we ended up concluding treatment at that point with the understanding that like, okay, if something comes up in the future, come back in,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So then we fast forward to, almost, let's see, this is almost 8 months later, 8 months after this. Okay. So the patient comes back in. And this is at the end, actually, of this summer. So at the end of this summer,
okay.
She comes back in And she said that for most of the time, the hot flashes, the most of the time in between the appointments, the hot flashes and the neuropathy had completely gone away. But within the last couple of weeks of the summer, they started to return.
Okay. So how long again between when you saw her and things were great and when she came back in?
It's about 8 months.
8 months. Yeah. So the majority of the year.
The majority of the year.
So of that 8 month period, most of the symptoms are completely abated.
Yep.
But then in the last 2-3 weeks, they've come back.
They've come back. Yep.
Okay.
And not as bad as before, but they started to come back and she's like, oh, I got to get back in. We got to start working on this. I don't want it to get worse. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So, she comes back in and this is important too. She described the summer to be extremely demanding and stressful.
Yep.
I recorded a quote here. I don't have 1 second to think.
Wow.
She came back in actually after her first child is back in school. So she has a little more time and space because during the summer, both of the kids are home.
Right.
Right. Now it's just the little one that's home.
Right.
And so she has a little more time and space for herself. Coincidentally, decides to come back in to get treatment. Right?
Sure.
So in this case, I assessed things and I found pretty similar situation to what I found before. There was noticeable recue on the abdomen. There was pulsations kind of between maybe we'll say CV 13.
Sure.
It's not maybe not that specific, but
good old 13.
Sure.
Use that one all the time.
Sure. When she came back in this time, I didn't feel a cold feeling on the skin in that particular place.
Okay.
But I did feel it was more striking to me the vacancy that I felt in the integrity of the tissue below the umbilicus. And there was a little bit of a cold feeling down there, actually.
Mm.
So I basically, the formula I gave her was huangqi jianzhong tang, and then I added in futsa.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe why don't you explain why that formula, and then I want to talk a little bit about the timing of the case.
Yeah. So that formula, in the Jingwei, so we kind of have three jianzhong tang formulas that we think about. The Shao jianzhong tang, which is the standard one.
Right.
We have Dangui jianzhong tang, which is introduced first actually by Sun Simiao. That's not a Zhanzhong Jing formula necessarily, but it's very close. And Dangui jianzhong tang is introduced specifically for postpartum insufficiency.
Okay.
So blood deficiency, qi deficiency after in postpartum.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Huangqi jianzhong tang, which Zhanzhong Jing says for all types of insufficiency, use Huangqi jianzhong tang. So it's just like, if there's deficiency, use this. If there's more deficiency, use Huangqi jianzhong tang.
Got it.
Right. I'm also thinking a little bit about the neuropathy at this stage being close to the one formula where numbness is mentioned in the Jingwei is Huangqi Guizhi Wuwu tang, which is another modification of Guizhi tang. And so I'm thinking about sort of leaning in that direction. Like I want to supplement the deficiency. I want to tonify more, but I want to tonify with a little bit of the Huangqi method because of the neuropathy piece. I'm thinking about that more specifically this time. So that's what makes me lean toward Huangqi jianzhong tang as opposed to just Shao jianzhong tang or Dangui.
Is there something particular about Huangqi as an herb that is connected to the neuropathy symptoms as you see it? Like what about Huangqi?
It's a good question. I don't know. It's in a lot of approaches to treat arthritis and neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
But Huangqi is, I'll admit, one herb that I don't understand that well. I'm still working on my understanding of it. I think the way that I think about it currently is that it's a sweet flavored herb. So it's a tonifying herb, but it has a kind of lifting property to it that allows to let's say, assists in the distribution of resources to the periphery. Mm. So if there's a peripheral problem, a symptom, an insufficiency, a deficiency, right, then huangqi is a useful herb to use in this case. I also took the story to be sort of an indication that the patient has been oversweating. Mm. So if I'm working too hard and it's the end of the summertime, it's been warmer, mm-hmm. the patient's been sweating, and it just so happens that the symptoms have come back, right? So in the Shanghanlun, there's all kinds of discussions of how someone damages their body by oversweating.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes it's through improper treatment or whatever, but oversweating is a big issue. So I'm thinking of the overwork, the oversweating as a taxation that's relevant to the oncoming set of the symptoms coming back.
So then sweet flavor from huangqi to tonify that resultant deficiency.
Yes.
And then the mystery of huangqi's uplifting quality and the other way that it right. works. Yeah. And this is something you and I have talked about, you know, offline many times, which is just that huangqi, it's mysterious. I mean, places where, like, really famous formulas we talk about a lot, like Buzhong Yiqitang.
Yeah.
You know, huangqi's a major player in that formula. And, you know, you give it and you can get it to work, but it's like, how exactly is this herb playing into it?
Yeah.
It is a little bit mysterious. I'm very interested in the seasonality of how this played out.
Yeah.
Because, you know, basically you would have been initially nourishing her enough in midwinter.
Yes.
Sort of November, December.
Yep.
Which is the ideal time for mm-hmm. restoration and nourishment, mm-hmm. right? That is the time for it. Warming internal, building up fluids, all that kind of stuff, right? And then it works. So, you know, in the seasonal cycle, the curve of things is toward restoration and rest in general and the building up of things that are deficient. Mm-hmm. So you give a formula whose pattern is oriented that way, mm-hmm. moistening and building. And then, man, it works like gangbusters. It takes off and things are doing really well. And then her body takes over that work mm-hmm. after the formula is done because it's the time of the year for it. So of course it makes sense that that is what's happening, right? Mm-hmm. And then she goes through the rest of the year, goes through the spring, goes through the summer as a mom of young kids and is just busy.
Yes. Right?
And doing stuff all the time, all the time, all the time. And so even though summer is the time for doing, so it makes sense that you should be doing stuff then, it also means that there isn't the same level of restoration in a body that already had a tendency to being depleted.
100%.
So then you get to the end of the season of doing in a body with a tendency toward depletion, who hasn't had enough time to restore during the time of doing. And all of a sudden, the symptoms that are fundamentally related to being depleted show back up.
Come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's difficult because, you know, we work with people and like the first part of this case is really great. Like I couldn't have predicted that the result would have been that positive that quickly, you know?
Sure.
But it was, and then treated for a little bit afterwards, maybe a month after we got the hot flashes and the neuropathy symptoms to go away. And then the patient's like, what am I still doing?
Yeah,
why am I still here? You know,
you
fixed me kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, you kind of run this thing through, or at least I do, where it's like, well, should they keep coming? Like, should they take stuff just to buffer the fact that it may come back later? Should we treat deeper? Like, what's the deal there? And I'll admit, I'm still figuring that out. But it's also hard to sell the patient on, no, you really need to keep taking herbs for like a long time.
Well, I mean,
even though your symptoms are gone,
in a perfect world, actually, though, their lifestyle would pick up the slack.
Yeah, it's true.
I think that's the problem, right? Yep. So much of the work that we do is plugging holes in people's boats.
Yeah.
And those holes get put there by life, by the demands of their modern existence. And stuff that people in a previous time or even, you know, modern people in different cultures might know about rest and restoration and seasonal change and stuff, like, we just don't have those beats. in American society. And so we end up in a situation where the solution, because someone isn't actually going to go to bed earlier and get up later in the winter, and they aren't going to make sure to build in quiet stare out the window time in the summer so that they can have the resources necessary to go, 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 go. They're just going to burn the candle at both ends.
Yeah.
And they're going to do it because as they see it, their life demands it. And there's not really any other way around it. And so our answer has been, in wellness culture writ large, to supplement.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Chinese medicine, there's a million patent supplements you can buy. Of course, you can go to your local grocery store, especially health food store, and there's whole aisles of every kind of everything you can take, you know, get your horny goat weed and your astragalus root and your whatever, you know what I mean? There's just so much supplementation that goes in it. And then there's even on the pharmacological side, people taking testosterone and estrogen and other hormones, because the idea is that you're just worn down, your life continues to wear you down, and there's not really, like, sometimes this is my struggle with it. I want to recognize the reality of the fact that people live in the world we live in. We don't live in a perfect world. We don't even live in a marginally good world sometimes.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for people, you know, like, what are you supposed to do? You got to go to work. You got to feed your family. You got to bring them to school. Like, literally, what are you supposed to do? Just feel guilty about what you're not doing. But then on the other hand, part of me wonders if one of the reasons that we don't do better, quote unquote, in this space is because we make room to do badly.
Yeah.
Right. And it's such a tension.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't think there's really much good in playing the blame game or the, like, moralizing the right choice, the wrong choice. I just, you know, that's a losing game.
Yep.
But also I really wonder if by just saying, like, yeah, look, you know, your life is really rough. Your job is terrible. Your spouse doesn't help and your kids are nightmares. So here, just take this, take this formula. It'll help you get through it.
Sure.
I think that's great in the short term.
Yeah.
Let's give you some bandwidth so that you can maybe figure out how to sort through these things that are causing you the trouble. But the problem is these things are causing the trouble.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to have that conversation with patients. In this case, you know, it's not so dramatic, but it's clear that, like, in when we would have hoped was that the patient's life would have been able to support and continue to nourish her in such a way that she wouldn't need to come back.
Yep.
But on the other hand, I mean, she did get 8 months out of feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
And then she came back to see you.
Yep.
You gave her a formula again.
Yep.
This time the Huangqi Jianzhong Chang. And then what happened?
So this was maybe 10 days ago or something like that. So she came back a week later and the symptoms were doing way better, but they weren't completely gone, but on the pathway to resolution once again.
I mean, that's what we would expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I see this with all kinds of, I mean, we're talking about in the context of menopause here, right? But I see this in the context of IBS where someone gets resolution, they're feeling great and they might feel great for a year, 14 months. Then they're getting some more frequent stool again. It's getting a little more urgent again. And then fortunately, because they know how this looks and that we can help, they get in here before it's a real problem. And then they'll take herbs for another 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then they'll get another 2 years out of stuff.
Yep.
And if they continue to manage their stress, eat mostly cooked warm food, you know, do the lifestyle things that we were just talking about, then they need a readjustment less and less frequently.
Yes.
You know, and they can use their lifestyle stuff to do it without us more and more. And I think that that's absolutely the same situation here with the menopause symptoms.
Yeah. I do want to say, for the sake of, if you're just getting into herbs and you haven't done this very much, doing 6 weeks of herbs, like, and maybe even less, like, have to go through and check this out, but and expecting that the hot flashes that somebody has are just going to go away completely is probably not realistic.
No.
You're going to need a lot longer, and you're going to be looking at, like, oh, it's better. They're less intense when they, I was sweating before and now I'm not sweating and they're happening 3 times a day instead of, like, basically every 15 minutes, you know, it's like going to be more like that.
Yeah.
And then eventually you can usually get them to a place where it's either not occurring or it's occurring very rarely. And that's pretty, pretty dang good.
Yeah, because I mean, this patient is exceptional, right?
This patient is exceptional.
You basically gave her 4 weeks of herbs and then the hot flashes went away.
Right.
Which is pretty
amazing. And this
is
a perimenopausal person, not a menopausal person, which is important to point
out. All the more reason, though, to catch it early.
To do it now. Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like if you wait for this to be the pattern of like, oh, I've had these hot flashes for the last year and a half. They're entrenched. Like, don't wait. It just gets worse. I think that point you made just there, though, about how symptoms abate is a really important one. And I think it's by and large true for almost any kind of chronic condition, which is that the symptoms don't, it's not like an on-off switch.
Right.
It's not like, oh, I'm having 12 bowel movements a day and now I'm good.
Yep.
Like that's never how it goes.
Right.
It's always a retreat of symptoms in frequency and severity, frequency and severity in some capacity, you know? And it's not always the same, right? Like someone might, you know, they're having, you know, 5-6 hot flashes an hour and they're super hot. Like they're sweating, they take their shirt off. That could go to, well, I'm actually still having 5 an hour, but they're just warm.
Sure.
I don't need to take my shirt off.
Yep.
Or it can go from, they're still crazy hot, but they're only 2 an hour.
Right.
Or you get both, where it's only 2 an hour now and they're less hot. That's great.
Yep.
And then the next stage of it, it's like, well, they're actually still the same level of hot, but I'm only actually having them like once a day.
Yeah.
But they're still pretty hot. Like it's, I think it's almost impossible and probably not useful to try and predict exactly which way it will peel back.
Right.
But it's important for the patient to know that that is the progress. That's the trackable progress is like, oh, it was this very specific way. We did all our measurables. We have a baseline. And now it's getting better either in frequency, how often it's happening, or severity, how badly it's happening, and some combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very rarely, almost never, on off.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's really worth explaining this to patients, by the way, for new herbalists that are out there. Like when you're talking about, when you're building a treatment plan with someone and you're like, okay, this is what I think is going on. This is what our initial herbal intervention is going to look like. Probably you're talking in the realm of at least 8 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, for a chronic condition. This is how much time a patient should anticipate. Not a solution, not a complete resolution, but like this is 8 weeks is how we'll know if this is working.
Yeah.
Like if we're a good match, if I can understand your case, if your body responds in the way that I think it ought to, and if this type of intervention even jives with you. Like we get people all the time never taken herbs before, and then they can't.
Right.
Some people just, they just can't. They're like, I can't do it. I can't drink them. I don't like the way they taste, or I can't remember or whatever. And if that's the case, well, no harm, no foul. This just isn't for you.
Right.
Like the medicine we have, you got to drink.
Yep.
And if you can't drink it,
we can't do anything.
We can't help you. And so, you know, but you don't know that.
Right.
Like people come in and they're like, oh, it'll be totally fine. I can do it. It's no problem. And then they do it and they can't. So that initial, when you're describing that whole initial treatment plan, it's worth describing or giving people an idea based on the specific case in front of you, how they might anticipate their symptoms abating.
Yes.
And if you can give them a sense that it happens in pieces like that, this severity frequency thing, in my experience, at least, you get a lot more long-term buy-in because people are looking at their case going like, oh no, things are better. Yeah. I still have hot flashes, but like it's definitely better. And that's really, that's important for buy-in.
And you always have the most available buy-in, pretty much almost the first session. Like people are the most open. They have the most variability with expectations, right? They're not expecting it to go a certain way or have to do a certain thing yet. And so you want to use that to your advantage to craft the space of the treatment and the process so that it's going to line up with what you need as far as time and space to work with the patient for them to get better.
Yeah, exactly. If the patient thinks it's going to go too fast or faster than it will, then you're going to have problems with buy-in in the long run.
Yeah.
I've even had this problem with patients who I've seen for, you know, condition, you know, A, and we had it kind of like with this patient, which it just went so well.
Yeah.
Problem solved in like 4 weeks.
Yep.
They're feeling like $1 million. And then they come in for another condition later, a completely separate one, because they're like, oh, this works so well for my, whatever, my heartburn. So I'm going to come in for insomnia. And we don't knock it out in 4 weeks. And it's important. And, you know, I'm always telling people the same thing. Like even people who have been in before, it's like, hey, this is insomnia. You've had it your whole life. It's probably going to take us 8-12 weeks to like figure this out. And then you might be taking herbs for a long time after that. And they're hearing me, but also they remember the last time I told them that it got fixed in 4 weeks. And so then when we get to the 4 week mark, they're like, oh, I don't know if these herbs are doing it.
I know.
And you have to be like, no, you're good, man. Like, you're still making progress. Remember how we said this is probably 8 to 12 before we make an evaluation, but it can be real tough because people, like, they got such good lift out of one condition in one round,
right,
that they're hoping it's going to go that way every time.
Yeah. One of my herbal instructors told me this story of bringing one of his patients to his teacher, and the patient, arrived to the clinic with the teacher's teacher, with my teacher's teacher, I guess, and said, you know, I'm really struggling. I'm glad I'm here. And, I'm not getting very much benefit from the treatment. And, you know, this guy was like, oh, well, great. You know, you're here. We're going to take a look at you. We're going to assess things and we'll set you straight, you know? So he does the assessment and then, just going through the case history a little bit verbally. And the patient was like 40% better from a rheumatoid arthritis chief complaint in like 2 months. And so he turns to this student and he's like, you got to work on talking to your patients better about this stuff. Like 40% for an issue that this person has had for decades.
Yeah.
In 2 months is a big deal.
And that the biomeds say there is no solution for.
Right.
Like, you can just take these various steroid medications and biologics and maybe it'll feel better. You know, that rheumatoid arthritis is a great example. That's like that's a cursed disease.
Yeah.
From a biomed point of view, right?
Yeah.
Like, whoop, womp, womp, short straw,
right,
you're out of luck. You're just going to hurt.
Right.
There's not much you can do about it. So yeah, a 40% improvement in 2 months for a lifelong diagnosis. That's a good point. This is a good point to remember, though, is that it's you gotta remind patients,
yes,
of when things are going well.
Right.
And I don't mean like selling them on stuff that's not true.
No, no, no.
Like, you're not trying to like make a mountain out of a molehill of like, oh, maybe my stools are better. Like, no, no, no. Like, ask them the questions. They report it back to you. And this is why it's important to have measurables.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the case that we're talking about here with hot flashes, it's like, okay, I'm having hot flashes. Okay. How often?
How often, yeah.
I'm not really sure. Well, I want you to think about it.
Right.
Like, start paying attention.
Are they daily?
Yeah.
Are they hourly? Mm-hmm. Are they happening a few times every couple of minutes? Mm-hmm. Like, you got to get some parameters.
How strong are they?
How strong are they?
I don't know. They're very hot. Like, so hot you start sweating immediately. You need to change your clothes. You
right.
need to stand in front of a fan. Like, what? Let's get some yes. terms in here.
Yes.
Because then if you don't do that, then you don't have any points of comparison. And somebody says, like, I don't know, I'm still having hot flashes. And I say, well, has the severity changed? Well, we didn't establish a baseline to start.
Right.
And now we don't have anything to compare to.
Right.
Maybe they're like a million times better, but the patient's just not plugged into it. So, you know, again, you don't make stuff up, but it's incredibly important to just, and when I say remind the patient, I'm not like, hey, let me point out, but this is actually a lot better. It's a little Socratic, right? Like, they say it. And then I'm literally looking at my chart and I was like, well, actually, you know, when you first came in here, it looks like, let me see here. Yeah, it looks like the hot flashes were actually, you know, 6-8 times an hour.
Yeah.
And you were having to stand in front of a fan. So where is it now? You're like, oh, well, I think it's not even every hour. So yeah, I guess that's better. Like, you
right.
know, because that's the thing is
right.
that I'm just restating what's in my chart.
Right.
As a real question, I do actually want to know. This is what you told me.
Yep.
Where is it now?
Mm.
And if they're like, oh, it's actually, wow, it is better. Like, mm-hmm. they can suddenly realize it, even though, of course, they've been living in their body the whole time, but they didn't notice.
It's very rare that somebody is neutral with their perspective on their own health, right? Usually people skew things positively or skew things negatively.
Sure.
And it's our job as practitioners to figure out, what is it really? Like, are they really getting better? And that's why parameters, objective, you know, things can be really helpful. Objective
Huge.
Findings.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, abdominal stuff, pulse checks, tongue over time. If you're doing long-term stuff, tongue is mm-hmm. helpful. And being able to really compare it, I think you're right. It matters a lot. Just to make sure that you and the patient are on the same page about how this treatment is improving, because it's time consuming, it's expensive.
Yep.
You want to make sure that it's valuable.
Yes.
Cool. All right. Well, Thanks everybody for joining us in a little case study conversation on menopause and some ongoing suggestions about how it's helpful to set parameters for your patients so that they know and you know that they're getting better. As always, if you guys have suggestions for show topics, send them over to us at thenervousherbalist@gmail.com, thenervousherbalist@gmail.com. And if you're listening to the show, we'd really appreciate a rate and a review wherever you're listening to it. It helps other people find us. And as always, we enjoy chatting with you. So I'm Travis Kern.
I'm Travis Cunningham.
And we'll catch you next time.
Catch you next time.